Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Save big this summer with great deals, all in the Kroger app. Get tender USDA Choice value packs of T-bone steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon, limit 5. Then buy one, get one free on select varieties of Entenmann's, Wonder Bread, or Vita Coco Water, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. I'm delighted to talk again to Professor Dale C. Allison. You're most welcome, sir.
Happy to be here today, this afternoon, at least for me. It's evening for you, right? Or getting close to evening.
Is. Yes, it's a particularly sort of cloudy, miserable day in London, but that's pretty normal for you, unfortunately.
It's nice, sunny, and warm here in Princeton.
Oh, you're so lucky. Oh, that was the place to go for holidays then. For those who don't remember, Dale is an American New Testament scholar and a historian of early Christianity. He is the Richard J. Dearborn Professor of New Testament Studies at Princeton Theological Seminary and an ordained elder in the Presbyterian Church, USA. Now, many people will be surprised to hear, perhaps, that Jesus had a brother, an actual blood brother, who we know in English as James. He has many other kinds of names. In Hebrew, he's known as Yaakov, and other iterations of his name in English are Jacob, for example. But James's prominent role in the early Jesus movement, this is in the first century, has to a very large extent been airbrushed out of subsequent church history. But scholars today have uncovered his role as, for example, head of the church in Jerusalem and his significant differences on a range of issues with the Apostle Paul. And Dale has kindly agreed, as one of the world's leading experts on the historical James, to discuss this remarkable figure with us today. So my first question, Dale, is, who exactly was James, and what are the historical sources that tell us about his life?
Well, let's start with the sources, and then maybe the rest of this can be who the heck this guy was, all right?
Yeah.
So if you just open the New Testament, first of all, you'll find that the Gospels refer to him as the brother of Jesus, but there's not much else there except that it appears that Jesus's family during his ministry, or at least for a significant part of his ministry, was estranged from him, wasn't really happy with what he was doing. Mark 3 seems to indicate that maybe they were worried that people thought he was out of their mind, and maybe he was out of his mind, and maybe they agreed with him. Anyway, not much more than that in the Gospels. Then when you go to the book of Acts, it's very interesting to find a character who isn't important in the Synoptics or John, who by the middle of Acts appears to be the main person in the church. But even then, it's sort of odd because there isn't much mention of him before chapter 15, and we don't really know how he became what he became and why there seems to be a great deference to him. Then he shows up a little later in Acts where he has a meeting with Paul. In Acts, there are a couple of meetings with Paul. Then you can go to Paul's epistles, and Galatians 1 says that shortly after Paul's call or conversion, whatever you want to call it, he went up to Jerusalem and he met with Peter and then he met with James. And he at one point refers to James and Peter and John, which is really significant because the order of names matters. Yeah. So if you think about the list of the apostles, Peter's always first and Judas is always last. So when Paul is thinking of these three people, he names James and Peter and John, and it appears that that's their order of seniority or whatever you want to talk, however you want to put it. But while he says in Galatians that he and James came to an agreement about certain things, you then find in chapter 2 that there are people sent from James who are having problems with Paul. And we can, of course, ask, well, what does it mean to have been sent by James? Were they fairly representing him or not? There's a huge debate, as you can imagine, about that. Anyway, so we have James as a major figure in Galatians. We also have him showing up in Josephus, who's our, you know, major first century Jewish historian. He has a little paragraph where he talks about the martyrdom of James, which to judge by his account would be about 62. Right. So when Paul's talking about James, he's writing in the 50s. By Josephus's account, he's been a martyr or been killed by 62. We also, I hope we don't get into this because I'm not an epigrapher or an archaeologist, but as you must know, there was an ossuary dug up, I think it was discovered 1962.
Yes.
And somebody a couple of decades ago finally got around to looking at it in detail and said, oh my goodness, this seems to say Jacob, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. Right. And then there's this huge debate. Is this authentic?
Yes.
If it's authentic, is this probably James? We can come back to that if you want. But again, I'm not an epigrapher, and the experts still disagree about this. It seems almost too good to be true. And
there's so many forgeries, aren't there, in the market, both manuscripts and archaeological artifacts. Uh-huh. It's awash with them. And some of these forgeries that have been discovered to be forgeries are really sophisticated. So I think a good dollop of skepticism is particularly, as you say, when it seems too good to be true.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Is warranted.
And there are a couple of epigraphers, again, this is not my area of expertise, who say that brother of Jesus might have been added by a later hand. And that originally it might just have said Jacob or Jacob, son of Joseph, and then somebody added. So it's controversial. It may be that we have this guy's bow, you know, his ossuary, but we don't know for sure. Now, once you leave the New Testament, and once you leave the ossuary, and then once you leave Josephus, then what you have...
I've noticed, by the way, sorry to interrupt, you've completely left out the letter of James. Is that deliberate?
No, that's just because we're doing this spontaneously, and I'm 68 years old, and I sometimes forget things. That's it. So we can come back to the letter of James is really interesting because it is almost certainly attributed to James. It just says James.
Yeah,
and the name doesn't need any qualification. And if it were not some other James, you'd think it would, you know, say that. So there is a question about the authenticity of this letter. Mm-hmm. But let me share my own point of view on this. All right.
Please.
I think when you think about James, you need to remember the debates about some of the Pauline epistles. So, for example, there's a huge debate ongoing as to whether Paul wrote Colossians. But here's the thing. It sounds so much like Paul that even if Paul did not write it, it's a good representation for the most part of Pauline theology. Yeah. And so there have been scholars who have said at the end of the day, it doesn't matter a whole lot, because this belongs to Paul's school, even if it's not Paul. So I think the same thing is probably true of James. That is, even if he is not directly responsible for writing it, the people who are, or the person who was, is writing in his name and probably represents the sort of Christian Judaism, or Jewish Christianity, if you prefer, that James was a part of. So we can come back to what the heck is going on in the letter of James recently, down the road. But again, it's like Colossians. If you look at the modern commentators, you can find as many who think he wrote it as think he did not write it.
Really? I mean, it always struck me as a layman, as a non-scholar, when I think of James, I think of Jesus' family. And I'm aware that, well, Bart Ehrman has stated 5-7% of the Greco-Roman world population could actually read and write. And in terms of the socioeconomic context of Jesus' family, okay, his father may have been a carpenter, but his disciples were fishermen. These were pretty low social economic status people. So they wouldn't have gone to Galilee High School and learned how to read and write. This is obviously a joke because there was no such thing as Galilee High School. Yeah. So the point being is that the chances of James, of all people, being able to read and write, I have had acquired these two quite distinct and separate skills in the ancient world, is extremely unlikely. Ergo, he probably didn't write the letter that is in his name, or at least in the name that he has.
So So I did write a commentary on the letter of James. I did argue that he probably didn't write it. And the reason you just gave is part of that. But you also have to distinguish, I think anyway, between the Greco-Roman world in general and the Jewish world, because the Jewish world does have the Torah, which says you're supposed to raise up your children in the law. And so there's an ongoing debate as to whether artisans knew or could have known some scripture. One of the things about the Gospels, it seems to me, is that Jesus is presented, or at least remembered, as somebody who can quote scripture off the top of his head. And I think even more interestingly, just refer to things like Sodom and Gomorrah, or Adam and Eve, or Noah, or Abraham, and allude to text. So however he got it, I think myself, the historical Jesus has a lot of scriptural text. Now, maybe he couldn't write. I think it's more likely than not, although this is a huge debate, that he could probably read some, but there are degrees of literacy, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Anyway, he is remembered as somebody who could quote scripture. Maybe he was just a really religious guy and went to synagogue a lot and heard things read over and over and over again and assimilated things that way. But in any case, I think that the Greek of James is probably too good. It's much better than the Greek of Revelation. The guy who wrote Revelation is thinking in Hebrew, in my judgment. He can barely write a Greek sentence. It's just terrible, horrible Greek. So Greek is his second language. James is much better than that. Yeah. So if he's behind it directly, he's got to be using scribes and people who are rewriting what he's saying. But anyway. I think it's unlikely. On the other hand, the people are using his name to write in. And I think the Epistle of James coheres rather nicely with everything else we know about this character.
It's very Jamesian, even if it's not actually by him. As you say, they're like the Colossians example. It's very of the kind of thought that you would expect Paul to have articulated in his work. So.
So, okay, I got James in there. All right. And then there are post-first century sources. Mm. The most interesting is preserved in Eusebius. Yep. And he's the great church historian.
This is a book we're referring to, I'm pretty sure. Eusebius, The History of the Church, published by Penguin. You can easily get hold of a copy online. Do recommend it. So.
It's really an important piece. And depending on how you classify the book of Acts, Eusebius is the first church historian or maybe the second. But anyway, he's the first one to write a lengthy account. And one of the things he does happily is he quotes at length other books that he's read. And so at one point, he quotes a guy named Hegesippus, who's flourished in the middle of the second century. And he has a really interesting account of James' martyrdom, James' death. He has James dramatically going up to the top of the temple and saying a few words about Jesus. This gets people angry. They toss him down. They push him over. He doesn't die when he hits the ground. And he forgives his enemies. They know not what they do. And then somebody hits him with a club. And that's the end of it. But it actually, to some extent, coheres with Josephus's account of the martyrdom. So it looks like for whatever reason, James.
Save big this summer with great deals, all in the Kroger app. Get tender USDA choice value packs of T-bone steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon, limit 5. Then buy one, get one free on select varieties of Entenmann's, Wonder Bread, or Vita Coco Water, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This did at some point alienate certain people with authority in Jerusalem. You know that we have ongoing debates as to why exactly Jesus was crucified, right? Why they did him in. Well, we have way more evidence for Jesus than we do for James on this issue. So that means we can only sort of guess what the heck the real problem was. Mm-hmm. In any case, so we have this account, and then we have later accounts. We have something called the Pseudo-Clementine homilies, recognitions. There are really interesting passages there where James is the opponent of John. Mm-hmm. James is the opponent of Paul, and Peter, doesn't get along with Paul, and so on. It represents some sort of second century Christianity for which Paul is a villain, right?
Yes.
He's not the good guy, and Peter and James are the good guys. They're the ones that got it right. And then, of course, there are lots of later legends. One point to make is that you referred to James as the brother of Jesus. That's, in my judgment, almost certainly the case. But there was an early tradition that he was Jesus's half-brother. That is, Joseph was married before he married Mary, and his wife died, and he had children by her. And so Jesus's siblings are actually from a prior marriage. Right. Now, that sounds like pure apologetics, because you want Mary to be a perpetual virgin, right?
So this is very much a Catholic view, which became the dominant view in Christianity.
Yeah.
Even the reformers, people like Luther and Calvin, kind of went along with that. It's so powerful as a belief. But historians, as you say today, tend to question that sometimes.
Yeah, I question it, but I never want to be dogmatic, and I always want to be modest and humble. And there are some ways of playing around with names in the synoptics so you can make this likely. I don't think it's the best hypothesis, but it's there. Anyway, you do, of course, have lots of later legends, because that's just the way religion works, as you know. The further you get from the hero, the more stories you get, strangely. Just one thing here. Jerome, in the 4th century, quotes from a book that we don't have called the Gospel of the Hebrews. And we're not sure exactly what this text was. And I'm uncertain about the fragments people attribute to it. But he says this is from the Gospel of the Hebrews. And weirdly enough, it doesn't fit with the New Testament, because in this account, James is the first one to see the risen Jesus. He sees Jesus before Mary Magdalene, Peter, or anybody else. Now, everybody, to my knowledge, thinks this account is fictional, and it's late. But it does reflect the tradition that James was really, really important. Mm. And there apparently was some tradition that somebody had that he was actually the first one to see the resurrected Jesus.
Well, what about the Gospel of Thomas? Does that have anything to say about?
So the Gospel of Thomas, first of all, I'm not somebody who thinks it's a first century text. It might have pieces that go back to the first century, but I think in its current form, it's put together in the 2nd century, and I think it probably does show knowledge of the Gospels at some point. But it does have this one really strange statement about James, and it says that the whole world came into being on account of James, the just or the righteous. So where that comes from, how it functions in the text.
Pretty weird.
It's really weird. But it does support the idea that he's a major figure in the early church, and that he's remembered as being such, and maybe even idolized by some people. So whoever put together the book of James, I think, idolized him and remembered him as a great hero. And anyway, you can go on and on and on, but that gives you a sense of things.
There's certainly the main sources that give us. This is multiple sources, some in the Bible, some outside of the Bible. Mm-hmm. 1st century, like Josephus, others 2nd century, which could be historically reliable. Eusebius, the great church historian, mentions him at length, quoting an earlier source. So we have lots of interesting and some quite long sources about this historical figure. The question is, of course, why does it matter about this person? And one of the things a lot of these sources say or state or assume, as Paul arguably does in Galatians, is James's very prominent position in the earliest church, right from the beginning, perhaps. Now, Catholics, of course, usually see Peter as the first pope, and thus as the prince of the apostles, the first, the preeminent one. But in fact, our sources don't always say that. I'm not going to go into the argument about, you know, Jesus founding the church on Peter in Matthew.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, that's a slightly different subject. I was talking about these sources that we have in Acts and so on. They do suggest that he, in some way, he was the leader or head of the church. And some of the sources say, you know, people like Peter and John appointed him or elected yes. him to be the bishop or the episcopus or the overseer of the church. And this is remarkable because we don't normally, or Christians don't normally think of him as the head of the church in the first century. They think of other people.
There are references to him being a bishop, an episcopus. And there are also references, which are using later language, to his throne. So his episcopal throne, which is in Jerusalem. I think what happens is that Peter, in part what happens is that Peter becomes a missionary. He's not as well traveled as Paul, perhaps, but he is going from place to place. And if he is, let's say, the most important leader in Jerusalem very early on, he exits the place at an early date. And so who is going to, you know, fill the vacuum? And apparently James, the brother of Jesus, filled the vacuum. It's odd because we're not sure why, right?
Yeah.
A part of it almost certainly has to do with the fact that he's a relative. So you know the issues about Muhammad and his successor and having to do with, you know, relatives and so on. So that's probably going on there. We also know, at least from Eusebius, he claims to know this, that after James, relatives of Jesus for a little bit continued to lead the church in Jerusalem. So there's some sort of family tie there that's important.
Or a dynasty, or a dynasty, as you say in America, a dynastic kind of succession. So therefore, James would be the successor of Jesus. So this is a revolutionary thought. And then after that, as you say, another source points to a distant cousin, I think, of the Jesus dynasty, as Professor James Tabor calls it in the cover of his book. We have another family member who takes over the Jesus dynasty. So the parallel there in terms of Muslim Islamic history will be with the Shia understanding of the imminate, the idea that the family of the prophet are the successors and their descendants and their descendants. And this goes on into the second century, even in the Christian context.
Yeah. Now, of course, it runs out at that point. One of our problems, as you know, is that our sources are from Gentile Christians, at least after you get out of the New Testament. So the sources are not that interested in Christian Judaism. And, you know, for example, Justin Martyr in the middle of the second century, he knows some of these people and he says he's okay with most of them, right? But he doesn't tell us anything about them. We know that there are Christian Jews up until the fourth century because we occasionally get little glimpses of them, but they are marginal, or maybe you would say they're marginalized. So what happens is somewhere in the late quarter of the first century, Christianity, which begins as a Jewish movement, it's dominated by Jewish figures. Paul is a Jew, Peter is a Jew, James is a Jew. All these people are Jews.
Yeah.
And with the exception probably of Luke, the whole New Testament, maybe there are a couple other exceptions, maybe Second Peter, but they are written by Jews or attributed to Jews. But then you get Ignatius, and then you get Irenaeus, and then you get the rest of them, and they are no longer Jewish. And heck, you even end up with Marcion, who says, as you know, we don't even need the Hebrew scriptures. We're, you know, we've got the right.
Before that, you have Ignatius of Antioch in his seven letters that are authentic according to modern scholarship, which he wrote on his way to be martyred, the very beginning of the second century. He spent most of his life in the first century as quite an elderly figure when he died. I think it's a letter to the Magnesians or something. He refers the first recorded instance in history, I think, of the term Christianity as such, as a as a noun. And he rebukes or chastises those who think they can adopt Jewish customs.
Yeah.
Sabbath and so on. He says, no, we are Christians. We follow Christianity. We don't follow Judaism. And this is arguably the view at the end of the first century, someone like Ignatius, who was a bishop of Ephesus, I think it was, or Antioch, and a very, very prominent bishop, still in the, his feast day is still remembered in the Episcopal Church and the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church, very insignificant figure. But you're saying this Gentile, because he wasn't a Jew at all, this Gentile figure representing a movement which had explicitly rejected the earlier Jewish faith from a few years earlier, represented by someone like James himself, the head of the church. So you have this incredible split, not just ethnically, but in terms of a new religion being born, which is called Christianity for the first time in Ignatius's letter.
So I think that Marcion is, now from my personal, I guess, ideological point of view, Marcion is the continuation of the worst of Ignatius. But if you look at something like the Gospel of Matthew is a Jewish text, and I think it was written somewhere. So,
because this is, you actually authored. This is the shorter commentary on Matthew. I actually had the full version, which is about twice the size. And this is, when I was at university, I was told this particular work is probably the most definitive work on the Gospel of Matthew, written from an academic point of view. It is outstanding, folks. You want a good commentary? Get this one.
Okay. Thank you very much for the plug. Anyway, so Matthew is written by a Jew, but the gospel ends with, you know, go into all the world. Yeah. And so my sense is that Matthew is somebody who's still trying to hold together the Jewish heritage and the Jewish view and the Hebrew Bible with these incoming Gentiles. He still thinks that they can be held together. And that's why he has Jesus talk about bringing forth from your treasure things old and new. He wants the old to continue with the new, right? Yeah. There's several really interesting hints to that effect in the gospel. But I think Matthew's vision was not realized. And I think what happened is that, so to speak, Matthew senses Marcion coming, and he senses the predecessors of Marcion coming, and he wants to keep things together, but it didn't happen. And so the church becomes a Gentile group with all the problems that creates.
But one of the things that is clear from your commentary, I don't want to be sidetracked really into the Gospel of Matthew, as fascinating as it is you and in common with many scholars, see the historical Jesus as someone upheld the Torah, a Torah observant Jew, not someone who in any way abolished the law. Do not think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. Although there's been great disagreement amongst Christian scholars over the centuries, and usually a very different view has prevailed, that Jesus, in fact, did abolish the law. You come down the view that he didn't abolish the law. And that seems to be the view of James. And coming back to James, if I may, in sort of jumping hither and thither in Acts chapter 20, 21 rather. I mention Acts because this purports to be the history of the church. Uh-huh. And I say purports because scholars disagree whether or not it's just, you know, historically reliable or whatever. But assuming for the second it is, and you already mentioned Acts 21, where Paul visits James at Jerusalem. And I just want to quote what Luke says here, the author of Acts, because it's so startling to me when I first read it. It really, I thought, what on earth is going on here? This doesn't make any sense. Because Luke writes, when we arrived in Jerusalem, whoever we is, presumably Luke, I suppose, claiming to be there, the brothers welcomed us warmly. The next day, Paul went with us to visit James, and all the elders were present. After greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. When they heard it, they praised God. Then they said to him, this is to Paul, I assume, you see, brother, how many thousands of believers there are among the Jews, and they are all zealous for the law. So these are kind of like Pharisee-type characters who embrace the faith, whatever that faith may be, and I don't want to prejudge that, and they're all zealous for the law. But they've all been told, they have been told about you, Paul, that you teach the Jews living amongst the Gentiles to forsake Moses, that you tell them not to circumcise their children, not to observe the customs. What should we do about this? And they say, they recommend that they go through a rite of purification. Just to prove, demonstrate that he hasn't been doing these terrible things. Thus, they say, this is James and the elders, I assume, all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, Paul, but that you yourself, Paul, observe and guard the law. Okay. Now, I read this and I thought, what? I mean, you know, I've read the Paul's letters to the Galatians.
Yes.
Perhaps the earliest letter Paul wrote. This is pretty anti-law. I mean, if I may give an opinion, not exactly saying, oh, the law's still in force, folks. No. It's saying that's an old dispensation. We are now following the Spirit. You know, Galatians 5, we follow the Spirit rather than the letter, and, you know, give the fruits of the Spirit and all that. But here we have James apparently saying, boasting about how many new converts are zealous for the law. There's a Torah observant Jews, something Paul surely would not have been happy with at all. Arguably, that's kind of what I'm asserting here. And then he goes through this purificatory rite, which seems a little bit disingenuous if the object of it is to demonstrate that he not only observes but guards the law, which is not really consistent, in my view, with what we read in Galatians, etc. So either Luke is not recording history, or Paul is being very, I'm being generous here when I say disingenuous. There are stronger words one could use. What is going here with Paul? And this portrays James as a kind of Christian leader that doesn't really exist today. I mean, the Catholic Church doesn't observe the law, doesn't advocate that, neither does the Anglican Church or the Presbyterian Church. It seems to be a form of Christian faith that is now become obsolete even.
Well, there are some Messianic Jews who do observe the law. So they're converts from Judaism who still obey the law, but they're not a major or significant force in modern Christianity. Well, my goodness. No. So there is, of course, and has been since the Enlightenment, a large debate, discussion as to what we do with these passages in Acts. So there are some scholars who would just look at these and they would say, well, this is reason not to trust Acts. And my view is that Luke, no matter what his sources or no matter who he was, wanted to paint a fairly rosy picture of the early church. He does not want to emphasize conflict. And I don't know how much history is there in Acts 21. I just don't know. I'm agnostic about that. But I will say this. I don't think Paul was Martin Luther, by which I mean Galatians isn't the same as Romans. I actually interpret Romans as Paul getting out of his anger. When he writes Galatians, he's just furious. He's not thinking at all. And I actually think that his opponents would have loved Galatians. They would have picked this up and said, look at this. This guy is really as bad as we say. There's no place for the law, and so on and so on. If you read Romans compared to Galatians, it has a more nuanced sense of the law and Torah and Moses. It's like he's backtracking a little and realizing, you know, that thing I wrote in Galatians, I got to qualify this, especially if I'm introducing myself to the Roman community, because they've probably heard all these rumors by now about how radical I am. But there are also things in Paul that make you wonder. So he says, I became a Jew to the Jews that I might win Jews. What the heck does he mean? I don't know. Again, our tendency is to interpret him through Galatians. And I think also in the background, Martin Luther is always there. And I don't know, if you saw Paul in the street, what would he look like? I'm guessing he probably would be dressed as a Jew. He would probably have his fringes and his phylacteries and so on. So I don't think Paul himself would have worried about Jews or Christian Jews keeping Torah. I don't think he would have told them, you can't do this, you can't do that. I think Paul's main concern is with Gentiles, and he doesn't think Gentiles should become Jews in order to be saved. So what then do you do with the Jewish Christians that think they should keep the law and then want Gentiles to keep the law? I think that there was probably a lot of agreement between James and Paul on certain things. At least Paul says it. He says that there was agreement, and they gave to me the right hand of fellowship and so on. So there must be agreement about certain things.
But there's things that agreement on. So it actually mentions it in Acts 15, doesn't it? James and Paul present, and Barnabas, and they all go out and agree on this. So not to eat blood, for example, and you know, not commit immorality, and not the you know, these are very minimal requirements.
Yes.
But the thing about eating blood, and there's about not eating food that's been a carrion or whatever the word is, but the blood thing is interesting because that corresponds to the kosher / halal food requirements that are still in operation today. But Paul, you say Paul agreed to that, but in Paul's letters, even in Romans and in 1 Corinthians, etc., Paul seems pretty clear that all food is clean. You can eat anything, actually.
Yeah.
And it doesn't repeat. And I checked the chronology of this as best I could. It seems that the council in Acts 15 is prior to Paul's letters. And so maybe that's the rub. But if I'm right in that, and I could be wrong, of course, then Paul is actually not agree. He's actually ignoring the apostolic agreement in narrated Acts 15. And there again, that puts a question mark against Paul's. What is he, a maverick, kind of maverick figure who just at the end of the day does what he wants to do because he knows Christ and therefore he can do no wrong?
But he also says Jesus appeared to Peter and James. He's not at the point where he wants to say, hey, these guys are fake and they're frauds and I disagree with them 100% and Jesus couldn't have even appeared to them. No. So, look, I think the problem is this. I don't think Paul had problems with Christian Jews keeping Torah. They were Jews. They were descended from Abraham. That's it. That's tradition, custom, and so on. What he's worried about is Christian Jews who say Gentiles have to keep the law. And he says, no. Now, in arguing, no, they don't, he does say some very radical things about the law, things that would have bothered, I think, other Jewish Christians. So he doesn't agree with Peter. That's quite clear in Galatians 2. He doesn't agree with Peter. And by the way, Acts has Peter having a vision. What is it? Acts 12, where all foods are clean. So it's really hard to sort through all of this. The one thing that I am pretty sure of is that Luke is idealizing things.
Yeah.
That, and he's probably conflating things. Ancient historians didn't usually have problems with things like this. So maybe there was a sort of letter that came from the Jerusalem church at some point, but maybe it didn't come out of a meeting that Paul was at. Paul does not seem to know.
Which is odd because Acts says he was there and he never refers to it in his teaching. He doesn't have to refer to the letter explicitly, but even in the substance of his teaching, he seems to go against what the council had described, the first apostolic ecumenical council, you could even say, prior to Nicaea. Nicaea is not the first. Jerusalem council is the first, I would argue. It's kind of odd, isn't it, that he doesn't know about it, which he should have done. Then Acts is not history. And if he did know about it, he's ignoring it. And this is a very, he's the least Catholic. Therefore, in that scenario, he would be the most un-Catholic apostle of all because he has no sense of ecumenical Catholic responsibility as a part of the College of the Apostles, as Roman Catholics would say.
Yeah.
So either way, you have a problem. Acts is there falsified on the one hand, or Paul is a maverick who just does his own thing and ignores apostolic agreements on the other. It's a lose-lose situation, isn't it, really, in some ways?
I suppose so. But the thing that's historically is important is what we said earlier, which is that inside the church, the Gentile group comes to dominate, and all the leaders become Jewish. They transition from Jewish to Gentile. And so the apostle to the Gentile becomes their hero. And Paul's letters are collected somewhere, I think probably at the end of the first century, somewhere in the first century already. Mm-hmm. And so everything's going to be seen through his eyes. And whoever Luke was, he also thinks of Paul as a hero. So he's going to see things through Paul's eyes. And that means we're not seeing things through James's eyes. So it's a really interesting question. When James gave the right hand of fellowship to Paul, was he thinking, you know, I'll just send him on his way. I have better things to worry about. I guess it's okay because they're Gentiles and I'm not worried about them much anyway. But there's one other thing that you need to think about, it seems to me, in this connection. So if you read Paul's letters carefully, there are a few times that he refers to the collection of money that he's taking to the Jerusalem church. And I think there are two things going on. One is he's probably operating with an end time scenario in which there are these texts where the Gentiles, you know, go up to Jerusalem and they bring their wealth with them. So he's going to bring the wealth of the Gentiles to Jerusalem, which maybe fulfills prophecy. But the other thing is that it's for the poor of Jerusalem. And I think he's hoping that when he shows up with this, things will go well. And they'll be reconciled and they'll say, well, okay, we really do agree and we get along and so on. But what happens is things don't go well. There are people in Jerusalem, maybe some of them were what we call Christians, who didn't like Paul at all. There's even an assassination plot at one point. So my point is that Paul is thinking he can still do something to get along with these people, right? So he's not thinking of himself as a wild antinomian. He can't be doing that. If he did, you know, they wouldn't listen to him at all. Actually has him going into the temple. Maybe he did. How would I know? I don't know. But Paul is trying to hold together worlds that fall apart and that don't hang together. A little like Matthew, not completely like Matthew, but he's trying to see if these Gentile churches can't be embraced by the Jerusalem church under the head of James when he shows up. Because, look, here we have all the gifts, and this is the fulfillment of prophecy. But it doesn't happen. And so, again, given that that Luke wants to paint a rosy picture, you really have to wonder, maybe Paul's collection was not accepted or accepted without enthusiasm. Luke, with one possible unlikely exception, doesn't refer to this collection at all. So I think it probably failed.
Now, you say that because if it had succeeded, then that would be a noteworthy event, and the reconciliation and the positive outcome would have been something really worth commenting on and mentioning. The fact that it doesn't is an argument from silence, but not, I don't mean in a bad way, but it's just, well, obviously things didn't quite work out as hoped. Therefore, we're just going to move on. We're not going to mention that.
So if the collection had been successful, I think there would have been a memory of that and Luke would have loved it and it would have shown up. So you're right. It's an argument from silence, but some arguments from silence are better than others.
It's a good argument. I'm just saying that's how you're doing it. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
But this one persuades me. So I think that the alienation between Paul and some people in Jerusalem was probably permanent. I actually would guess that Galatians probably sealed his fate for some people. That is, for all I know, once the Galatians heard this letter, somebody either copied it and sent it to Jerusalem, or news would have gotten, he says this, he says that. In Romans, you might remember, there's a point at which he says, some people say that I say, do evil that good may come. So his opponents are seeing him in a certain way. And you know how this is. When you have opponents, you don't see them usually in a charitable fashion. You usually think the worst of your opponents, right? And so these people are going to hear Galatians and they're going to think the worst of Paul. And I don't think he's ever able to overcome that.
Yeah, I mean, he was accused of being antinomian, and even some people today who accuse him of that. I think it was unfair and unjust, because clearly at the end of many of his letters, you get an epilogue-like chapter where he exhorts them to be moral and uphold values. So he wasn't antinomian. I know what that's coming from, perhaps some sense of the kind of anti-law position which some people think he may hold, say in Galatians. But that's not the same as being antinomian in the sense of being advocating licentiousness or a completely immoral lifestyle. There is another kind of Pauline middle road here or whatever.
Paul's ethics are for the most part very Jewish, and you know, Jews would have thought of them as deriving from Torah. You know, the old Christian notion isn't completely 100% wrong. The old notion that somehow the ceremonial law or the ritual law is gone, but we still follow the moral law of the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish scriptures. Paul has a Jewish God, right? Mm-hmm. His God is the Jewish God. His God is the God of Scripture and the God of Moses, and his moral teaching, Paul's moral teaching, he would have thought of as being in line with the Ten Commandments, Leviticus 19, and so on. So, I don't think of Paul as an antinomian. On the other hand, some of the theoretical statements in Galatians are really radical, and you do wonder about Paul himself. Is he, when he's eating with Gentiles, what exactly is he doing? What is he doing?
Well, I would guess he's eating their food without any sense of worry at all, because in 1 Corinthians and other places he says that, because you know, if your weak faith causes you to stumble, don't eat it. But the implication being, if you're a strong believer, you can eat Gentile, which means eating non-kosher food, presumably pork even. I mean, he didn't say that, but that would be surely an inevitable thing. You would eat.
Well, it's quite possible that you're right. I go back and forth on this issue myself, but he is criticizing Peter for not fully participating in the meals in Galatians 2. Okay. So,
can we go back to James, though? Uh-huh. As fascinating as Paul is, because he looms over the whole New Testament, perhaps as much as Jesus in some ways, or perhaps more so, depending on how you configure the historical Jesus. But so we concluded, our sources tell us that James was, and this is in some contrast to Paul, arguably, a Torah observant Jew who upheld the law and was actually famous for upholding the law. I think Josephus mentions this, that he wasn't just a Jew, he was someone who was passionate and zealous about the law, if Acts is right on that as well. And what does this tell us? This is a slightly different take now about theology. What does this likely tell us, given that he was a Torah observant Jew, James? What does this tell us about his view of his brother? and even soteriology, that would be the same. That is a huge question. The reason I ask this is, I mean, later Gentile Christians came to see Jesus as, at Nicaea, obviously, as fully God. But even before that, there was a sense that Jesus was a divine being, maybe subordinate to God the Father, but nevertheless, not just human. Is it possible that such an Orthodox Jew, if I can use anachronistic language here, James, could have seen his brother in that language, or would he have seen his brother in very Jewish Tanakh terms as a prophet, a Messiah, God's specially chosen son in that metaphorical sense you get in the Torah, of course, and not as a divine being? Because that would have been just too un-Jewish to countenance.
Okay, so there I have to disagree. So I don't know what James himself thought. And for us, it's really weird to think, oh, my brother is a divine being. That would be exceedingly odd.
Well, my brother's God, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is that in Judaism, so you have a book that is a pre-Christian book that goes by the name of, under the name of Ezekiel. And it's a Jewish drama which retells the story of Moses. And in this story, Moses sits on the throne of God. He holds the scepter of the universe. He can count the stars, which of course only God can do. And the heavenly powers, the angels, bow down in front of him. So this is some sort of really weird picture of a divinized Moses. And Philo can also use theos in fairly pregnant terms of Moses. Yeah. And it was a Jew who wrote Daniel 7. You know that, the one like a son of man who comes on the cloud of heaven, clouds of heaven. That really is sort of like those old Canaanite myths where the old God departs and the new God takes.
True, but with approaching the Ancient of Days, who is a separate being, it's not like he is the Ancient of Days. Of course, no. And that is a metaphor for Israel, is the Israel, because it says that in Daniel 7:12.
But he is taking the place somehow of this figure, or at least that seems like the myth in the background. And the rabbis will talk about those who argue: are there two powers in heaven, or are there only one? And some, they know some Jews who think there are two powers in heaven. So I think we have to be real careful here. But I would just say I have no idea about James's Christology, right? Mm-hmm. I just don't know. One of the fascinating things about the book attributed to him, the book of James, is that there is no real Christology at all. In fact, Jesus is mentioned only two times, once in 1:1, and then the other is 2:1, and the Greek is so weird in 2:1 that I think it's possible it's actually an addition. We know that scribes added the name Jesus to several other verses in James. But the point is, even with 2:1, there's nothing about the resurrection. There is nothing about Jesus' crucifixion. There's nothing about the Last Supper. There's nothing about his death for sins. Just go down the list of things you think of as typically Christian. They are not there in the book of James. I had a colleague who taught Old Testament here at Princeton, and he told me a few years ago, he said, you know what? He said, if you just take five or six words out of James, it could appear in the Old Testament. That was his comment. And a few scholars, I don't think they're right, but a few scholars have said, hey, this is a Jewish work, and a Christian has taken it up and added a couple of things to Christianize it slightly. But the point is that it is strikingly silent about all sorts of things, including just naming Jesus. And, you know, you can debate what the meaning of that is. I personally think it's a deliberate strategy. Well, I don't know. Maybe this is a good, you wanted to talk at some point, I guess, about the letter about James as a bridge figure.
Exactly. I just want to finish off about the letter of James. You mentioned the first verse or the first sentence. It says, reading from the NRSV, James, a slave of God, doulos, they translate it as servant, but the footnote says slave, which is the Greek. Uh-huh. James, a slave of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I just observe there that on the one hand, we have God and James is a slave of God. And then we have Jesus as a separate being. So there's no incarnation there, or let alone Trinitarianism, which would be anachronistic anyway, or even binitarianism. There's God and Jesus. And you get that kind of language in Paul's letters quite in the beginning, don't you? The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. The same kind of, but they're not identical, and they're not even like different facets of the Godhead. They are separate. There's a metaphysical difference, what I'm trying to say, it seems to me.
Anyway. So I don't know that we want to get into early Christology here, but all I'll say is this. The early texts are confusing. If they were not confusing, there would not have been these debates in the second, third, and fourth century, and you would not have honest, good-hearted people disagreeing about what the heck is going on. So you can argue that Paul himself doesn't make a lot of sense because, you know, you can read Philippians 2 in terms of pre-existence and being in the form of God, and what the heck does that mean? What is pre-existence in the form of God? But my point here would be, if you want to look at the letter of James, and if you think the person is either James who's writing or somebody writing in his name, I actually think that the omission or the absence of anything that you might think of as distinctively or we might think of as distinctively Christian is probably a strategy. So one of the things that I discovered a few years ago when I went through a bunch of early Christian sources with this question is that you can find Christian sources that are not Christian. That is, their Christianity or their specific beliefs are in the background. And, you know, this is a podcast. So, you know, forget the details. But there are texts where people, Theophilus of Antioch, who's a bishop, he can write a couple of books and not say anything about Jesus Christ other than some of his moral teachings. And what the historians think is that what these writers were trying to do was find common ground with other people. And you know how this is. So we all act a little differently around different people. We act properly for the occasion. And Origen says at one point, the great Origen says that when he would debate or talk to pagan philosophers, he wouldn't tell them he was a Christian up front. He'd rather debate with them and argue on their own grounds and find things in common. And then the discussion about, you know, his special beliefs were later. You can find it with the followers of Rabbi Schneerson today, the Lubavitchers. In some of their literature, they just present themselves as Orthodox Jews. We're Jews who are alienated from the modern world. You know, this is what we teach. It's only once you reach a certain point in talking to them that they'll say, oh, we also have some special beliefs that, you know, might surprise you. So I actually think that James is probably written by somebody who is still in the synagogue and wants to still be in the synagogue. You'll notice that it's not written to churches. It actually says it's written to the 12 tribes. It presents itself as a letter to Jews, not to Christians. And I think the content fits with that. And in chapter 2, there's actually a reference to the synagogue, right? Mm-hmm. And every single word or phrase in there that does have a Christian usage, you can also find, I've done this, I've gone through the whole thing word for word. Every single word or phrase that you might think of as being Christian, like ecclesia, which we usually translate church, that's used in the Septuagint for the gathering of Israel.
Assembly, it is translated in English.
Assembly. So absolutely everything in that text that you can, if you want to, read as Christian, you can just as easily read as Jewish. And I think it probably fits in with this fairly large body of apologetical literature where you are finding common ground. I don't think James is an argument. It's more like a presentation. Here's what we think, right? Here's what our James thinks. And actually, we're not in line with that Paul guy you may have heard of, because he believes in justification by faith. We believe in works too. Chapter 2 actually sounds to me, I think it can be almost demonstrated, that it's polemic against Paul, or at least some perception of Paul, that he is this guy who says faith without works, that's just fine. This text says, oh no, we don't believe that. We believe in works too. Yeah. So I don't know how this text was received, but you know, if I had to guess, it's not because the author doesn't think anything distinctively Christian, but that the author is actually trying to do what a lot of these other early Christian texts do, which is find common ground. And then that will lead to your modern ecumenical question.
I think that is then the point. Coming then to that very point, actually, about James, the historical James, as a potential, not a unifying figure, but a bridge figure that can, where points of contact can be made, surprisingly perhaps, between Jews and Christians and Muslims, actually. And this is a really interesting, some writers like Jeffrey Butts, the professor at Penn State University in America and a Lutheran minister, have written quite a bit on this, actually, in an encouraging way, trying to see James as this pivotal figure. But it does make assumptions about James, which you may or may not agree with, that James, in not having these distinctive Pauline themes of the abandonment of the law, for example, or justification through faith alone, if Martin Luther's right, and so on, James clearly doesn't follow that. But to the extent that he doesn't, he actually aligns himself with a more Jewish / Islamic perspective, where obeying the law does matter, and it's part of the obedience of the good Jew or the good Muslim to follow God's law, variously called the Halakha or the Sharia, of course. So Do you see any mileage at all, though, yourself in James as a figure that these three Abrahamic faiths can perhaps connect with in their own unique ways?
Yes, I think so. And I also think the letter of James probably works that way or can work that way. I actually remember reading some people who said, if you want to have a dialogue with Muslims, the place to start is with the book of James. Read the book of James together and see how much you you agree on this. So that makes sense to me. And again, it certainly works for Judaism. That is, this is a completely Jewish text. And as my colleague said, you could, you know, take out just a tiny, tiny bit and you could stick it back there in the Hebrew Bible and maybe nobody would notice anything. Mm-hmm. So, yes. But see, I think it was designed that way. Now, I can't prove this, but given that I know of other literature in the second and third centuries, which do this with pagans, for example, that they'll, you know, a Christian will write a text and there'll be nothing specifically Christian about it. It's what Christians and pagans have in common that they're, you know, they're arguing for, or some type of general, maybe what we would call theism, something like that. Mm-hmm. So this is something that's done in antiquity. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think James presents itself really nicely for that. And maybe, better than probably anything else in early Christian literature.
Okay. We'll leave on that positive note, perhaps. I think it's a good
okay.
place to end. I mean, I could go on forever. I'm sure you have better things to do than talk to me about this. But there are 1,001 theological / historical / other issues that we could talk about. I just wanted to highlight, as you've done marvelously in this podcast, the great prominence and significance of James, an historical figure, as a religious figure, as a Christian figure in the first century, and how he's been obscured by the rise of Gentile Christianity, as you've explained, and his potential bridge building potential, if only perhaps through his letter, or if not that, through his historical significance between the Abrahamic faiths, just to show that actually there is a lot in common. Actually,
yes,
just appearances of country.
Of course, there is.
Of course. Okay. Well. okay. Good. Well, thank you very much, Professor Dellis, and for your time. Fantastic to welcome you back on Blogging Theology. And inshallah, I understand you're having a bit of a sabbatical later this year, and I wish you a very peaceful and restorative time away from work as well.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Assalamu alaikum.
Bye-bye.
Smoothie King's new lemonade lineup is here.
Lemonade, lemonade, the Smoothie King way.
Try a strawberry guava lemonade SK refresher.
Yum, yum, gotta get some.
Made with real fruit, real juice, and real energy.
Who's thirsty?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on new windows now at Menards. Update your home with vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows in store or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more window deals happening this week now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Save big this summer with great deals, all in the Kroger app. Get tender USDA Choice value packs of T-bone steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon, limit 5. Then buy one, get one free on select varieties of Entenmann's, Wonder Bread, or Vita Coco Water, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.